This is Audible.
Harper One and Harper Audio presents How to Make Disease Disappear by Dr. Rangan Chatterjee. Read by Matthew Waterson. Introduction. We are sick and getting sicker. In the United States today, a new generation of children has been born that has a lower life expectancy than the generation before it. This is shocking and extraordinary. To understand why it's happening, we first have to grasp the terrible epidemic of chronic disease that's currently laying waste to millions. Chronic diseases such as type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, depression, and dementia are today the nation's leading causes of death and disability. Half of all American adults currently suffer from a chronic disease, with one in four people suffering from two or more. Chronic disease is, by a wide margin, now the deadliest problem facing America. Despite the statistics and the suffering, so much confusion exists about what we can do in our own lives to protect ourselves and live long, healthy lives. I have seen this firsthand as I've lived and worked with many families. The good news is that I can make these diseases disappear. That's right. This probably sounds like an extraordinary claim, but the reason I can make them disappear is that they're an illusion. These diseases are not the inevitable result of aging. They are not simply our genetic fate or our destiny. We do not have to suffer needlessly. The truth is these diseases don't really exist, at least not in the way we think they do. To come to this conclusion, I first had to travel down a long, hard road. 17 years ago, I graduated from medical school full of enthusiasm and passion, ready to go out and help people. But I always felt there was something missing. I started off as a specialist and then became a generalist as an MD. But I always had this nagging sense that I was just managing disease or simply suppressing people's symptoms. And then on December 28th, 2010, a turning point came. That was the day my son nearly died. I was on a skiing vacation with my family in the stunning snowy landscape of Chamonix, France. My son had been a little phlegmy and quiet all day, but I wasn't too worried. It was just a cold, and I felt sure it would pass without issue. That evening, my wife, Vid, sat on the sofa watching TV while I was in the kitchen. I was watching the kettle, waiting for the water to boil, when I heard her shout, "Rangan, he's not moving!" I rushed in. "He must be choking," I said. "It's the phlegm." I lifted him out of Vid's arms, turned him over, and slapped him over the back in an attempt to clear his airway. But nothing happened. "Rangan, he's not choking," said Vid. "We need to go to the hospital." My son's arms were stretched out. His body was rigid. His eyes stared vacantly. After a panicked rush down a snowy road that almost ended in my turning the car over, we found ourselves standing in the resuscitation room of the emergency room of the tiny L'Hôpital du Pays de Mont Blanc. As I watched the doctors take his temperature and try to get an intravenous line into his neck, I ran through the possibilities of what might be wrong with him. Was it epilepsy? Was it something more serious? I couldn't think. I felt numb. The truth was, I didn't have a clue. In that moment, I was no longer the doctor with nearly 10 years' experience who'd graduated from the prestigious University of Edinburgh's medical school. I was a terrified dad. 5 long, agonizing hours later, the doctor came in to see us, waiting by our son's bed. "Dr. Chatterjee, we have an update," he said. "What is it?" I asked. "Dr. Chatterjee, your son's calcium levels are very low. In fact, he has almost no calcium in his body at all. He experienced a hypocalcemic convulsion. We're going to give him some intravenous calcium." My reaction was utter confusion. How had this happened? What did it mean? But my confusion in that moment was nothing compared with the shock I felt when I did finally discover the root cause of what happened. It was an entirely preventable vitamin D deficiency. This was as unbelievable as it was serious. Untreated, especially in children, vitamin D deficiency can lead to painful and permanent damage, including deformities to the bones, a condition known as rickets. I was devastated, and I swore that I would never allow anything like it to happen again. The crisis of my son's illness forced me to ask some honest and uncomfortable questions. Why had I not been made sufficiently aware of vitamin and other nutritional deficiencies during my supposedly top-of-the-line medical training? And why wasn't that training proving more effective in my practice? As an MD, my days were filled with seeing patients with chronic conditions such as joint pain, headaches, type 2 diabetes, insomnia, depression, weight gain, and fatigue. I hated to admit it, but the fact was, I reckoned I was helping maybe 20% of these people. The approach to consultations I'd been taught in medical school simply wasn't working. And if my medical training was failing me so badly for so many of my patients, what else could I do but embark on my own course of re-education? And so began an incredible journey through many new worlds of knowledge that, I'm sad to say, the majority of doctors still have relatively little idea about. I immersed myself in research, especially around nutrition, movement science, stress reduction, ancestral health, and functional medicine. I also came across research that allowed me to see afresh what I'd learned while completing my BSc honors degree in immunology, gaining valuable insight into the rapidly developing field of gut health and the microbiome. I started applying the science, first with my family and then with my patients. Do you know what happened? People started getting better, really better. I'd finally learned to resolve the root cause of their problems, rather than simply suppressing their symptoms. What I'd learned, in a way that I hadn't fully grasped before, was that acute disease and chronic disease are entirely different things. Acute disease is something that, as doctors, we're pretty good at. It's relatively simple. You have something like pneumonia, a severe lung infection. So in your lung, you have the overgrowth of some bugs, typically a type of bacteria. We identify the bacteria and we give you a treatment, typically an antibiotic that kills it. The bacteria die and, hey presto, you no longer have your pneumonia. The problem is, we apply that same thinking to chronic disease and it simply doesn't work. Chronic disease doesn't just happen like this. Chronic disease has many different causes. You don't just wake up someday suffering from one. By the time we give you the diagnosis, things have already been going wrong for a long, long time. Let me tell you about one patient I met whom I found to be struggling with an all-too-common chronic disease. 35-year-old Mary was struggling with weight problems, joint problems, sleep problems, and fatigue. I did some blood tests and diagnosed her with type 2 diabetes. This is one of the most harmful chronic diseases the world is currently facing. 1 in 10 Americans currently has type 2 diabetes, and 1 in 4 has its precursor, prediabetes. The vast majority of sufferers don't even know they've got it. Between 1990 and 2013, rates of the disease shot up by an incredible 71% in the United States, one of the most dramatic increases of any nation. It currently costs the U.S. alone more than $245 billion a year. Within 30 days of treating Mary, I'd made her diabetes disappear. 2 years on, her disease is nowhere to be seen. Most cases of type 2 diabetes are caused by something called insulin resistance. Insulin is a very important hormone, and one of its key functions is to keep your blood sugar tightly controlled in your body. Say you have a sugary bowl of cereal for breakfast. What happens is your blood sugar goes up, but your body releases a little bit of insulin, and that helps it come back down to normal. The problem is, After years of dietary abuse with sugary foods, the insulin begins to lose its power. As you become more insulin resistant, you need more and more insulin to do the job. You can think of it as a little like alcohol. The very first time you have a drink, what happens? Let's say some wine. One or two sips, or maybe half a glass. You feel tipsy. You feel a bit drunk. As you become a more seasoned and accustomed drinker, you need more and more alcohol to have the same effect. And that's what's going on with insulin. You need more and more insulin to have the same effect. When the insulin can no longer keep your sugar under control, despite its best efforts, we say you've got a disease, type 2 diabetes. However, things will have been going wrong in your body for many years before that. But what causes insulin resistance in the first place? Actually, it's not just diet. It could also be that you're chronically stressed. Work stress, emotional stress, physical stress. They can all raise levels of cortisol in your body, which raises your sugar, which in turn can contribute to insulin resistance. It could also be sleep deprivation. In sum, losing one night of sleep can trigger as much insulin resistance as 6 months on a junk food diet. It could be age. The muscle mass we naturally lose as we get older can also cause insulin resistance. The problem is there are many different causes of insulin resistance, and if we don't address all the causes for that particular patient, we'll never get rid of their disease. For Mary, I addressed the causes for her, and a few weeks later, she no longer had her disease. That's right. In just a few weeks, no symptoms and no type 2 diabetes. What about other chronic disease? As we live longer, many of us will have to face the devastating consequences of Alzheimer's. It's a heart-wrenching condition, and doctors and researchers are scrambling around trying to find the cure. It might surprise you to learn that one expert, Dr. Dale Bredesen, has successfully reversed early cognitive decline in some of his dementia patients. He's done that by working out what the various triggers have been in his individual patients and correcting them, reversing their symptoms. And which triggers is he looking at? He's examining many different factors, including diet, stress levels, and sleep quality, as well as physical activity levels. Other prominent researchers in the field are applying similar strategies and are getting encouraging results. Is this sounding a little bit familiar? These are some of the same causes of insulin resistance that gives us type 2 diabetes. What if these, as well as many other seemingly separate chronic diseases, share common root causes? I believe they do. The problem with the way we think about health and practice medicine is this. We forget that the human body is one big connected system. If it starts being treated poorly in one area by bad diet or lack of sleep, problems can emerge in another part of it, often emerging as a so-called chronic disease. Then, if a patient presents with depression, we'll prescribe an antidepressant. But depression can just as easily be driven by poor diet or high stress levels, or, even more likely, both. It's the same with a condition like eczema. Doctors all too often just prescribe a steroid cream for the rash, but the rash is only a symptom. There's very little awareness that the causes of eczema are many, and that it may be triggered by an overreactive immune system that may itself be caused by food choices or abnormalities with gut bacteria. A human being is a highly evolved biological mechanism that's completely, what I call massively, interconnected. Because of this, a symptom in one domain might actually have a cause way upstream, in an area of the body that our medical training just doesn't tell us to look in. Because everything in our bodies affects, to a greater or lesser degree, pretty much everything else, we need to take a much more global view of treatment, one that considers every aspect of the way the patient is living their life. How are they sleeping? How are they eating? Do they sit behind a desk for hours a day not moving? Are they constantly on their phones? I call this the threshold effect. The massively connected system that is in the human body can deal with multiple insults in various places, up to a point. And then the system breaks down, often with a new problem in some distant part of the system. That point at which it breaks down is our own unique personal threshold. When talking to patients, I liken it to juggling. We can often juggle one ball, two balls, even three or four. But when we throw that fifth one in, all the balls fall down. We get sick. That sickness might manifest as a skin complaint, or a blood sugar problem, or a mood disorder, or difficulty sleeping. These complaints are all downstream signals that things, usually more than one, are going wrong upstream. Unlike many other doctors, I start upstream, not down. I'm not a scientist. I'm a doctor. And they are not the same things at all. My job is to read the science, then interpret it in the context of the patient who's with me. The science doesn't tell me everything I need to know. Something essential also comes from hearing a patient's individual story. I believe the most skilled and effective healers are the ones who listen. I also believe that medicine is art and science. It's the blending of the two. We too often forget this and are then surprised by all the discrepancies there are between what lab trials show and what we find happening in real life. Science doesn't do everything. I don't give two hoots if there's a study to show reducing our exposure to social media makes us less stressed. You can get data to show black is white and white is black. You can manipulate trials and data to say what you want. What I'm giving you is my 17 years of experience as an MD, seeing tens of thousands of patients. But this is my belief. It's based on science, but it's also based on my own experience. If you disagree with me, I'm okay with that. I believe my decade and a half of practice qualifies me to make simple recommendations that, as long as they do no harm, don't need to wait for all the science to catch up. By practicing this way, I've managed to avoid sending hundreds of patients down the road of medicalization and cured many hundreds more. I have written this book to provide a simple, actionable plan to help you take control of your health. There's nothing in here that's got any downside. No confusion, no bad science. Just practical solutions based on 17 years of clinical experience to help disease disappear. The benefits will happen immediately, and the results last a lifetime. This is a radical health journey that's designed for everyone. The worst thing that's going to happen, and I don't think it will, is you end up feeling the same. The best? You'll completely transform your life and have a lot more of it to live. The tools in this book may seem simple and even somehow unmedical, but don't be fooled. They will have a profound impact on your biology. They'll make a difference to your hormones, to your inflammatory cytokines, to the level of reactive oxygen species in your blood, and on and on. These are not soft interventions. This is not soft medicine. This is real medicine that is targeted especially to our unprecedented epidemic of lifestyle illnesses. You can't expect to avoid the deadly diseases that have taken so many millions of lives if you continue living without it. Let's go beyond the typical health advice we've been reading about for so long, beyond the fad diets and quick fix programs. We have overcomplicated health, and I want to simplify it. This book is the practical, achievable approach you have been waiting for. Everything you need to know about starting or continuing a radical health journey is in these pages. Join me as we make disease disappear. How to use this book. First, be sure to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider. It contains useful information, charts, exercises, and more, and will be referred to throughout as the enhancement. There are four main elements or pillars to the plan. The aim of the book is to examine and improve the manner in which you relax, eat, move, and sleep. For each pillar, I've set out 5 ways you might do this, summarized in the opposite table. The idea is to create balance across all the pillars. It is not about perfection in each individual one. I would much rather you score 2 in every pillar, giving you a total score of 8, rather than 5 out of 5 in 2 separate pillars, giving you a higher score of 10. The numerical score might be less, but the balance is greater, and this is the real point of the book. Achieving balance is what will lead to the biggest improvements and, most importantly, the sustainable ones. This is designed to be a whole life plan rather than a quick fix gimmick. For most of my patients, most of the time, doing 3 in each pillar, resulting in a total score of 12, seems to be about right. It is simply impossible, however, for me to say what will be the right amount for you. Some of you will need to do more, some can get away with less. It is possible, though, to take each pillar in isolation. You may already feel, for example, that your diet and exercise are already dialed in, whereas your sleep needs a bit more attention. If this is the case, feel free to go straight to that individual pillar and start there. You do not need to go through the book in sequential order if you don't want to. I want you to personalize this book so it suits your own life. Give equal priority to every pillar and proceed at a pace that is comfortable for you. Relax. 15 minutes of me time every day. Weekly screen-free Sabbath. Keep a gratitude journal. A daily practice of stillness. Eat 1 meal per day around a table without an e-device. Move. Walk 10,000 steps per day. Twice a week do a form of strength training. Twice a week do a form of high-intensity interval training. Daily movement snacks. Daily glute exercises to help wake them up. Eat. Denormalize sugar and retrain your taste buds. Eat 5 different vegetables every day. Eat your food within a 12-hour window. Drink 8 glasses of water per day. Unprocess your diet by avoiding food products with more than 5 ingredients. Sleep. Create an environment of absolute darkness. Spend at least 20 minutes outside every morning. Create a bedtime routine. Manage your commotion. Enjoy your caffeine before noon. Relax. What I'm about to say probably sounds far-fetched, but here it is. The health problems of the majority of patients I see, yes, the majority, are driven entirely by their lifestyle. It's not cuts or bruises or bacteria or a fungus or a virus or some tumor or hereditary disorder that's the source of their pain, but the way they're choosing to live. Their conditions are very often exacerbated by the fact that they're super busy. They wake up fully stressed, rush to get the kids ready, do the school run, come back, try to juggle their jobs and their home life. On top of that, they might have other family members who require care and attention. From the moment they open their eyes, it's all go, go, go. Then, when their kids are finally in bed, they're straight into their emails or social media. At no point in the day are they just chilling out or even alone. Everything they do is for someone else. When I mention this in my office, they roll their eyes, telling me, "But I just don't have time for me." To which I reply, "Well, that, right there, is your problem." Give yourself permission to relax. I never thought that, as a doctor, I'd have to give anyone permission to do anything. I see my patients as adults who can make their own decisions. But daily experience has taught me that, when it comes to relaxation, a surprising number of people don't get any. So, here I am, giving you doctor's orders. I want you to give daily relaxation as high a priority as food, movement, and sleep. I think our lack of routine switch-off time is one of the most pressing issues in modern society. For your health, it could hardly be more critical. In this relax pillar, as in the other 3, you'll find 5 different interventions. While you are reading through them, start to think about which ones resonate the most and which ones you might be able to introduce into your life right away. I would love you to adopt at least three. But if that seems too daunting, build up to it by taking on one at a time. I'm the type who's always desperate to jump in and attempt the lot. But we're all different, and it's really important that you find your own pace. It really doesn't matter how you get there, as long as you get there. The relax pillar is the one I struggle with the most. However, despite many challenges along the way, I've seen the benefits in my own life. I've also seen it in my practice. Potential gains include weight loss, improved resilience, reduced feelings of stress, improved ability to cope, more balanced outlook, less road rage, improved ability to sleep, more restorative sleep, better concentration. There is a reason why I've started this book with the relax pillar. It's the one that most often gets ignored, both by the public and also by the plethora of quick-fix health books that are out there. Which intervention should you start with? I genuinely don't believe there's much between them, but if you made me choose, the two I would prioritize are the first, carving out some me time every single day, and the fourth, a daily practice of stillness. The benefits are not only immense, but can also be rapid, which will help you engage with the others. 1. Me time every day. Every day, for at least 15 minutes, be selfish and enjoy some time for you. For at least 15 minutes every day, and more if possible, stop everything and be utterly selfish. Stop treating relaxation as something that you do, or more likely, don't do, when everything else has been dealt with. Choose to relax. Make it a triple underlined part of your schedule. Set an alarm. What will you do? Will you visit a local cafe, buy a coffee, and indulge in a trashy magazine? Will you sit in a room with the lights off, listening to your favorite piece of music? Will you enjoy a relaxing bath? It's entirely up to you, but there are three rules. Firstly, it must be something unashamedly for you and you alone. Secondly, it must not be an activity that involves your smartphone, tablet, or computer. Thirdly, you're not allowed to feel guilty about it. Cortisol surge. Had you told me this a few years ago, I wouldn't have believed it. But simply setting aside little moments every day can make a massive difference to your health. There are many reasons why these breaks make a difference. But a principal one is that they can help us to switch off our overactive stress response. Now, we all have cortisol in our bodies, and we all need it. Cortisol is a hormone, and a hormone is a chemical messenger. When we feel hungry, satiated, aroused, angry, and so on, it's because particular hormones are surging around our bloodstreams. Cortisol has been identified as one of our principal stress response hormones. Hormone levels tend to spike and fall at different times of the day, in natural cycles, and also rise and fall in response to the things that are happening to us. Our cortisol level surges when we're stressed. Contrary to popular belief, stress isn't necessarily bad for us. We've evolved to experience stress for all sorts of good reasons. An onrush of stress primes our minds and bodies to tackle a sudden problem head-on. But we're designed to experience stress in short bursts. When we endure it for a sustained period, it becomes a problem. To find out why this is, we must cast our view back hundreds of thousands of years. Humans are the product of an extremely gradual process of evolution that took place over many millennia. Our bodies and brains have been specialized, not for modern living in towns and cities, but for existence in roaming hunter-gatherer groups of no more than 150 people. Because this kind of evolution occurs so slowly, our ancient systems haven't caught up with 21st century life. Our machinery for responding to and dealing with stress is still largely prehistoric. And that mismatch between the ancient biological technology we have in our bodies and the complex, ultra-modern lives we're living can have some pretty nasty effects. Imagine what kind of stresses our bodies were designed to cope with all those years ago. If we were attacked by a lion, say, that experience would be terrifying, but it would also be short-lived. Either we'd have run away and escaped, or killed the lion and the danger would have passed, or we'd have been killed. That's the kind of event our stress equipment has been built to deal with. Our autonomic nervous system is a bodily network around which signals and instructions are transmitted, and there are two parts to it, the sympathetic system and the parasympathetic. Cortisol works by activating our sympathetic nervous system. This is our flight or flight response. And what I'm seeing in my practice is that people are constantly in fight or flight mode. They're spending their days with their cortisol levels continuously ramped right up, their sympathetic nervous systems activated. They're not being attacked by a lion. They're being attacked by their life. Cortisol steal. This is harmful for a number of reasons. Firstly, there's something called the cortisol steal. All the hormones in your body are made from the same basic stuff, which is called LDL cholesterol. We naturally have a limited supply of LDL cholesterol, and when things are working well, it all gets portioned off nicely, so there's enough to go around. Enough to make your estrogen, your progesterone, your testosterone, and also your cortisol. But what happens when you're in one of these long-term states of stress is that cortisol steals the other hormone's LDL cholesterol. Because it thinks you're under attack and in a state of crisis, your body prioritizes the generation of cortisol. It thinks you need it to cope with the drama and just makes more and more of it. That upsets the finely tuned balance of hormones in your body. This leads to a wide variety of problems. Clinicians know we're currently seeing an increase in numbers of men with low testosterone. This impacts things like sex drive, muscular strength, energy levels, and even risk of chronic disease, and testosterone prescriptions now cost the NHS, National Health Service, the UK's healthcare system, something like £20 million, about $27.6 million per year. I'm convinced the underlying problem in many of these cases is stress, leading to overproduction of cortisol at the expense of other hormones, of which testosterone is just one. But it's not just the cortisol steal we need to be concerned about. When we're constantly stressed, our bodies respond as if we're under attack, going into a kind of emergency mode and diverting resources to the processes most necessary for survival. To take just one example, digestion switches off. When you're dealing with a lion flying at your head, the efficient processing of lunch is just an unnecessary diversion. A more pressing need is the generation of instant energy in your bloodstream. In the short term, this is great, but when this becomes long term, it creates a problem. It can lead to weight gain and sleep disruption, and exhausts the immune system. Remember, all of this is happening because the body thinks it's under attack all day. While there are an infinite number of stressors in our environment, there's only one main stress response. Your body can't tell the difference between emotional stress, physical stress, and nutritional stress. It can't tell the difference between the stress of missing a mortgage payment or the stress you feel when someone's been rude to you on Facebook. To your system, it's all just a lion flying at your head, and it reacts in the same way in every case. The two parts of the autonomic nervous system. Our autonomic nervous system regulates our automatic processes, the things we do without consciously thinking, like breathing and digestion. One branch of this system, the sympathetic nervous system, causes the body to release stress response hormones such as noradrenaline and cortisol. It causes your heart rate to quicken, your lung tubes to widen, your muscles to contract, and your pupils to dilate, and it switches off digestion. It helps divert energy away from processes in our body, such as digestion, that are not necessary for our survival. It helps us release energy from our muscles and lowers immune system function. In the short term, this helps us deal with the stress. But if activated long term, this response can become problematic. In the modern world, this fight or flight system activates when we're rushing to meet a deadline, getting stressed on our commute, leaving late for the school run, or putting ourselves through a tough workout. This response can be managed as long as we take steps to balance it out with rest and relaxation. This rest and relaxation involves the other branch of our nervous system, which is the parasympathetic. It works at a much slower rate than the sympathetic branch. When it's activated, our saliva production increases, digestive enzymes are released, our heart rate drops, and our muscles relax. It allows us to digest food appropriately, de-stress, and sleep soundly. To help manage the stress of modern life, we should be encouraging the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. All five interventions in the Relax Pillar will help you do just that. Impact on your digestive system. You know when you get that mid-morning hunger surge? You've had your bowl of sugar-coated cereal, your blood sugar's gone up, then mid-morning it's crashed. You're starving. You're shaky. You need something to eat. When your blood sugar falls suddenly like this, that's another stressor, another lion at your head. It can send your cortisol and adrenaline soaring. So even something as simple as choosing the wrong breakfast can tip your body into this emergency state. Then what happens? Not only are you likely to go hunting in your fridge or cookie jar for some more bad food, your digestion is suppressed, so it's a double hit on the weight gain. This is another example of why it's crucial that we view the body as a massively connected system. One potential cause, in this case, a sugary breakfast, can have multiple effects, including stress, the cortisol steal, and weight gain. Impact on your immune system. But that's not all. When your body thinks it's under attack, it puts your immune system into an emergency state. This makes perfect sense from an evolutionary perspective. Imagine if you managed to survive that lion attack by fighting it off. It's likely you'd be left with cuts that were prone to infection. The animal would have had nasty bugs in its claws or saliva, and your wounds would pick up dirt from your environment. This is why your immune system needs to go into a peak state. We call this heightened immune response inflammation. And again, we're not supposed to be in this state for an extended period of time. Chronic inflammation, in medical parlance, any nasty condition that hangs around for too long is referred to as chronic, underpins pretty much every single degenerative disease that we have, including heart attacks, strokes, and even Alzheimer's disease. A 2016 paper published by researchers at King's College London highlighted just one of the ways inflammation can have a surprising impact on the massively connected body. They showed a remarkable link between inflammation and depression. The scientists suggested we can predict which patients suffering from depression will respond to conventional antidepressants by giving them blood tests that show their levels of inflammation. Crucially, they found that patients with high degrees of inflammation do not respond to conventional antidepressants. The results confirm what other scientific research has been suggesting for years, that depression itself can be a symptom of biological changes in the body that are driven by inflammation. This is why antidepressants don't work for these patients. If your problem is not in your brain, if it's actually inflammation in your body, what's the point in giving you a drug that's going to tweak something in your head? Think about how astonishing this is. If someone is depressed, the textbook medicine approach points out clinical gaze at possible struggles they're having in their life, or past traumas, or perhaps even chemical problems in their brain. But the root cause might just as easily be inflammation that's caused by having too much cortisol charging about their system for too long. This is how healthcare needs to evolve, into an era of progressive medicine characterized by the growing awareness that the name of a disease can often tell us very little about the actual cause. Depression is simply a name we give to a collection of symptoms. The word itself doesn't tell us anything about the root of the problem. Understanding all this is increasingly transforming the way I practice medicine. Recently, I was consulted by Miranda, a 52-year-old whom I hadn't seen for about 6 months. She had been following all my advice, but now had seemed to plateau and was not improving any further. I spent a long time chatting with her to try to figure out why. As we got into her story, it became clear that she had no time for herself at all. She was always on the go, and she never stopped. When I put this to her, she said, "Family life is just stressful." I tested her saliva. As I expected, her cortisol levels were through the roof. I kicked myself for not going down this path sooner. Stress is now a critical line of investigation I pursue in relation to a huge array of complaints. Stress and menopause. I've treated menopausal difficulties in women by helping them deal more effectively with their stress levels. These women have a problem with their hormones, namely estrogen and progesterone. The textbook medicine approach often results in doctors prescribing a course of hormone replacement therapy, HRT, which can comprise various combinations of these female hormones. Not only is HRT a cost burden on the patient and the healthcare system, it can also have some unpleasant side effects, including bloating, swelling, nausea, cramps, and even vaginal bleeding. There are also ongoing concerns about possible increased risks of ovarian cancer, breast cancer, and blood clots. There's no doubt that HRT often works, but is it always necessary? If the patient is stressed, most of her body's LDL cholesterol is likely going straight into making cortisol. This means there's less of it left to make estrogen and progesterone. HRT deals with the symptom, but why not go to the root cause instead? Normalizing cortisol levels, whether through meditation, or from sectioning off some daily me time, or even from switching to a whole food diet, which helps reduce the nutritional stress caused by low-quality foods, very often alleviates menopausal symptoms entirely. Stress and the gut. Using these principles, I once treated a 40-year-old woman who had a bad case of Crohn's disease. Crohn's is a nasty bowel complaint, and she'd been getting painful stomach cramps and kept needing to go to the bathroom. Nothing seemed to be helping her, and she'd reached the point where she was losing patience with a specialist. Eventually, she came to see me. I made some changes to her diet that helped for a while, but she quickly plateaued. I couldn't understand why this was, so I decided to delve deeper. I soon realized she literally had nothing in her daily life for herself. Everything was to do with her kids and her husband. She was going at full speed all the time, never putting herself first. "Are there any other medications I should be trying?" she asked. "What else should I do with my diet?" "You know what?" I said. "I'm going to try something completely different. I'm going to give you another appointment in a month. In the meantime, here's what I want you to do." I took out my notepad and wrote a list of three things. 2 15-minute periods for you per day, a walk every morning, and find something to do at least twice a week that you love and that you do just for you. After falling out with her specialist, this was the last thing she wanted to hear. I could see it written all over her face. She thought I was reverting to soft, woolly, paternalistic medicine. Perhaps she even felt patronized. She had a serious illness, and she expected serious medicine. "And what about supplements?" she asked me crossly. "What about medication?" "That's it," I said. "That's all I want you to do." I pushed the note toward her. "This is your prescription." Now, I knew this patient very well. Despite her suspicions, she trusted me, and I was hopeful that she'd at least give it a chance. When she came back 4 weeks later, I was delighted. She told me she'd joined a salsa class, which was something she'd been thinking about for years, but had never done because she didn't think she had time. She'd also started going out for a walk in the mornings. She'd spent time in her living room, leaving her phone and laptop on the kitchen counter, just sitting and listening to music for 15 minutes. We completed a medical symptom questionnaire, which is designed to measure objectively the effects of illness with questions such as how often she had stomach cramps or bowel movements. Even I was astonished to find her Crohn's symptoms had reduced by 50%. This kind of reduction in a 4-week time frame for a condition as complex and serious as Crohn's is simply incredible. What, to the outside observer, might be even more surprising is that the symptoms of Crohn's are located in the gut, and none of the interventions I gave her seemed to have anything to do with that part of her body. But I know that if cortisol is up, it won't just affect how calm you're feeling, it will affect your gut function. Not only that, but your inflammation markers go up, and the way your cytokines, which are chemicals that send messages within the immune system, behave changes. What does all this tell us? It tells us that the body is massively connected. Although she had a gut problem, her non-switching off problem was making it worse. Of course, I'm not saying this will work for every Crohn's patient. There's simply no trial that says that this is the way to treat it. And nor is there likely to be. But that's not because interventions like this don't work. It's because everyone who has Crohn's is different. I feel strongly that, as a doctor, I should try to follow my own advice, and, by and large, I do. One of my patients, a firefighter, once told me the only reason he was going to do as I suggested was that I was the first doctor he'd seen who actually practiced what he preached. I'll be honest, though. In the past, I have struggled to find time for me. But not anymore. I have built me time into my daily routine. At my last practice, midway through the morning, I allowed time for a 15-minute walk. Reception knew not to book anyone in between 10:15 and 10:30 a.m. Even if there were patients waiting, I would still stop everything and go for a stroll. At first, my manager wasn't at all happy. Why is he doing this when he ought to be seeing patients? But she quickly realized that I would still see as many patients as anyone else, if not more. Recently, I re-engaged with cooking while having a favorite CD on. It is amazing how relaxing this can be. What can you do to give you your daily dose? Cytokines. Cytokines are proteins released by the immune system. They work as messengers, taking the information being put out by the immune system around the body. They are essential to immune system function and are involved with coordinating the initiation, maintenance, and resolution of all immune responses. Maintaining a delicate balance in the level of these communicators is vital for health. The immune system releases cytokines in response not only to infections and traumatic accidents, but also to triggers such as stress, food, and exercise. Their release is tightly regulated, as their impact can be severe. Some of them cause inflammation, while others have the opposite effect. Some, including interleukin-6, can serve both functions in different situations. Examples of phone-free me time you might consider. Having a bath. Going for a walk. Sitting in a cafe having a drink. Sitting on a park bench relaxing. Reading a magazine. Reading a book. Singing. Playing music. Gardening. Cooking with your favorite album playing or in silence. Painting. Dancing. 15 minutes of yoga or tai chi. Relaxing at home with or without music. You can also bring in components of your daily stillness practice. I prioritize me time. It's scheduled into my daily timetable. In today's world, there's always something else to do. An email to send, a Facebook feed to scroll, a tweet to reply to. It's never ending. That's why you need to make a proactive decision to prioritize that time. One of my recent patients, 44-year-old Suzanne, was busy juggling motherhood and a part-time job. When she told me she didn't have time for herself, I said to her, "Suzanne, after you've dropped the kids off, you go straight to the shops, back home, straight to emails, and then you'll go, go, go all day until it is time to pick them up. What would happen if your car broke down? You'd stop for an hour or so while you waited for the breakdown service. That would enforce your switch-off time. You'd still get everything done afterward, wouldn't you?" This resonated with her. She made it a rule every day after the kids were dropped off to go for a phone-free 15-minute walk, rain or shine. 6 weeks later, she felt like a different person. She was less stressed throughout the day and, counterintuitively, actually became more productive and got more things done. This tiny change had a huge impact. Just by making space for yourself for 15 minutes per day, as Suzanne did, you can help normalize your cortisol levels. Your body will be reminded what it's like not to feel under attack. I contend that modern living, even if it's something as simple and common as your email inbox overflowing, is stressful. I find it stressful. And what's the downside in our busy culture of actually trying this? There's none whatsoever. Ironically, it's the people who say they don't have time for these interventions who need to do them the most. 2. The Screen-Free Sabbath. Every Sunday, turn off your screens and live your day offline. It was a typically hectic day at my Oldham practice, at the end of a Monday afternoon, and I was running late. In the NHS, we're allotted 10 minutes for each patient, and it's easy to find your appointments running into each other. Your only hope for getting back on track is to luck into seeing a few people you can deal with speedily. This is what I was hoping would happen last summer, when a 16-year-old named Devon came in, accompanied by his mum. But the moment they sat down, I realized this would be anything but a quick one. "Dr. Chatterjee," said the mother, struggling slightly to get the words out, "on Saturday night, Devon cut his wrists with a knife." "On purpose?" I asked. "On purpose," she nodded. "I had to take him to A&E, the emergency room. The psychiatrist there said we should see you for antidepressants. We're here for the prescription." It would have taken 30 seconds to write them a note for Prozac and send them on their way. But something stopped me. We started chatting and slowly Devon began to open up. I knew I had patients who were being delayed, but I also knew I couldn't do this boy a disservice. I needed to understand, why would a 16-year-old boy from a seemingly well-balanced family start self-harming out of nowhere? As I probed, I discovered that he felt like a misfit at school, partly because of his hobbies and partly because of his appearance. I started asking him about social media usage. "Do you go on it quite a lot?" "I go on it loads," he grinned. "Do you use it in bed at night?" "Yeah, I'll go on Facebook, I'll be texting." "Look," I said, "I'm wondering whether your use of social media is contributing to this in a small way." His face fell, and his mother looked dubious. "Would you consider reducing it?" "Why?" he said. "I'm not sure it's helping your mental health. Your self-harming is a symptom. I want to find out what's causing it. An hour before bed, how about if you just switch your phone off? Do you think you could do that?" He said, "I tell you what, why don't you give it a go for a week? If you're still feeling the same, I'll write you that script." I imagine that some of you may have been getting palpitations just from reading the title of this chapter. I know how you feel. I used to feel that way too. It's not that I'm against social media or the internet, not at all. But I am seeing a huge rise in problems that stem from their use. This is hardly surprising, given their rapid ascent and infiltration into every aspect of our lives. It's now thought that there are more mobile devices on the planet than people. Truly remarkable. Some of us, me included, can find it hard to leave our e-devices alone for more than 10 minutes. If I'm playing with my kids on a Sunday, and my phone's nearby, there's a constant nagging impulse to look at it. And I know for a fact that I'm not the only one. We are encouraged to keep on checking our feeds, to see how many likes or followers we have, or to update ourselves on the latest gossip. We have even started looking at our work emails on our days off. This contributes to the wider problem, one that's become exponentially more problematic since the introduction of smartphones. We are all finding it harder to switch off. When we open our eyes in the morning, instead of letting our bodies gradually awaken, we're straight onto Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat or whatever the latest social platform is, letting this constant stream of noise into our brains. And this noise is a huge problem. 5 years ago, I was convinced that the root cause of most of the complaints I saw in my practice was poor diet. Now, I'm convinced it's stress. Smartphone addiction. There's quite a bit of controversy out there about whether or not we can, in a truly clinical sense, say that the use of smartphones can be addictive. But real-world experience has left me in little doubt. One 2014 study of 2,000 people in the UK painted a disturbing portrait of the average user. We check our phones 221 times a day, starting at around 7:31 a.m., when we'll look at Facebook, read the news, and check the weather before we've even gotten out of bed. By the time we go to sleep, we'll have spent 3 hours and 16 minutes on our device. An even more alarming statistic from the US estimates that the average user touches their phone 2,617 times per day. A large part of why these numbers are so ridiculously high is the fact that we're now constantly contactable and subject to a ceaseless barrage of emails, calls, and texts. But what's also happened in the last 10 or so years is the beginning of an unhealthy selfie culture that feeds our phone addiction even more. Studies suggest that humans spend as much as 40% of our speech time informing others about our own subjective experiences. It's believed that doing this fires up neural pathways associated with reward and activates addiction centers in the brain, such as the nucleus accumbens. It's easy to see how a few selfies with mindless updates on Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat can start to create a feedback loop in your brain where you crave more and more of the same. My experience has been that, just like many drugs, the more you use your smartphone, the more addicted you become. We've evolved to enjoy social validation. We're highly social creatures. Just as the company making Snickers bars takes advantage of the fact we've evolved to love sweetness, so social media takes advantage of the fact we've evolved to crave the approval of others. But, just like the 6.75 teaspoons of sugar you'll find in a Snickers bar, we were never designed to have so much of it. When the massively connected human machine was evolving, we expected to have sugar now and again, especially in the summer. This is what that machine still expects. It's what it was designed for. We also used to have the tribe applauding us once every now and then when we did something truly selfless or brave. But we now live in an age when we can have all these things all the time. We're overusing all our built-in evolutionary mechanisms. And you'd have to be naive to think there aren't going to be consequences. An additional problem is what psychologists who study social media are now describing as perfectionist presentation. People don't tend to post on the bad parts of their day. They tend to focus on the good stuff. This creates a false reality in which it can seem like everyone else is much more successful and enjoying a much better life than we are. We all tend to compare our lives to other people's and judge ourselves accordingly. These are automatic processes. We can't help it. In vulnerable adolescence, this can be an easy road to stress and depression. It can be just as harmful in adults. Reset your relationship. One way in which you can start to reset your relationship with the electronic media is by altering how you use your smartphone. I've tried this over the past 18 months and immediately felt the benefits. Taking notifications off your phone is a great place to start. All your apps are still there and functioning, but every time someone likes an Instagram comment you've liked or checks your profile on LinkedIn, you don't get a notification. You could extend this further by turning off the auto-sync on your email inbox. Now, you have to physically request your email inbox to refresh. I used to be addicted to the sight of a new notification on the screen of my phone. Now I don't see them. I can pick my phone up to make a call, blissfully unaware that I have 10 new emails waiting for me. This may not sound like much in isolation, but when you think about how many times we look at our phones every day, this adds up to a lot of time. You could even try introducing a device box at home, into which everyone in your household has to drop their phone before meals. The possibilities are endless, and it is simply impossible for me to say what will end up working for you in the context of your own life. What helps pretty much everyone, however, is making some kind of change, no matter how small. Remember, every time you hear a notification or the ping of a new email, you activate reward signals in your brain that leave you craving more. What I hear again and again from my patients is that they had no idea how great an impact their e-device was having on their lives. There's no downtime.